This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. The indoor mask mandate was lifted by the government last week, with masks only deemed necessary in public transport, healthcare settings and care homes, as well as for those who have tested positive for COVID-19. Today, we'll be discussing what this development means for the way we manage the pandemic moving forward. While some of us may be relieved by this news, others are being cautious. A look around public areas in the Klang Valley shows that most people are still remaining masked indoors, especially when they're around other people. And this is all the more pertinent for people who are immunocompromised, such as older adults or people who have diseases or are under treatments that suppress their immune system. First up, let's hear from Liu Weizi, who's 24 years old and has psoriasis, which is an autoimmune disease. Weizi shares how she's been affected by the pandemic since she was diagnosed with her condition.
Hi everyone, I'm Weizi. I am 24 years old this year. I have been diagnosed with psoriasis last February. So in the context of autoimmune disease, how it affects me facing COVID-19 is that because this psoriasis is an autoimmune disease, that means my immune system is overreacting and like attacking the healthy skin cells. So that's why it creates inflammation, and then like that's why the skin cells keep like multiplying up to 10 times faster than the normal people. So that's why what my doctor did for my treatment is to suppress the immune system. So yeah, so he has been prescribing me immunosuppressant, which is methotrexate, which is also used to treat cancer. So I've been taking it for like about 1.5 years now. So I have to admit that I do enjoy like, you know, how my skin clear up and my joints like stop aching, and you know, it has been good like that. But then the downside to it, and also to let other people know the dangers of methotrexate or immunosuppressant, is that my immune system became very bad, impaired. So for the past 6 months, I have got infected with COVID for 4 times. So in March, May, July and September, and all 4 times are confirmed by PCR test. So as you can imagine, it has been a big toll on me in terms of like emotional wise and also like physical wise. I think the emotional one outweighs the physical one. So I have to admit that I'm very lucky in the sense that although I've been infected 4 times, but then 4 times I'm able to manage it at home, because I know some of my friends, they have to ask one of my friends, she has to go to the hospital, and then one family friend of mine passed away because of COVID. So I have to admit that I'm very, very lucky. So the first, third and fourth are quite okay in terms of like sore throat, headache, maybe like nausea, sneeze, like fever, that kind is still quite okay. The second time was the most serious one in terms of the, I got everything. I mean, not to say go to hospital that time, but then like normal sickness that type, like, and everything is like bum bum bum, like very full impact. So like headache, fever, everything. So at that time I felt like very, very sad, like, because like all these sickness come at a very heavy impact all at once. And then right after my COVID sickness, I have period. So that time my period, the cramp was like the max, the most painful one I've experienced in my whole life. So that time I was basically sitting beside the toilet bowl on the floor, and then I kept crying, like, because it was too painful. And then I want to vomit, but I couldn't vomit, and then I couldn't walk or couldn't like eat or couldn't talk or anything, like, for like a few hours. Anyway, this is like a domino effect, like. So firstly, psoriasis lead to this vulnerable to COVID, and then getting 4 times, and then after that, the second COVID lead to like the super painful period cramp, like. So yeah, a domino effect, like.
Despite all these physical effects that Weizi has described, the emotional toll, she says, has been even worse for her. Let's hear more about that.
Like, for physical sickness, right, it's just like maybe for days or like for a week or two. But then the emotional toll is that in terms of like every time, right, when I take COVID self-test, every time when it's negative, it's not like a normality, it's a blessing. So every time I'm very scared, I'm very like, maybe some will call it paranoid or something, but then I think this is inevitable. If like you have been getting it very frequently, it will be paranoid. So yeah, every time when like when I feel a bit sick, then I can feel that, oh, it's the COVID coming, because I can feel like a certain type of sickness, like maybe like headache a bit, dizzy a bit, sore throat a bit, then I know already it's the starting of COVID already. Then so the thing is that I will feel very, very scared for the people around me. So every time I will feel fear and maybe a bit of guilt and like, yeah, a lot of fear because anxiousness, because I'm afraid that the people around me will get infected as well. Another thing is the long-term quarantine and, you know, always avoiding to attend any outings. So I'm basically missing out on life, like, because I know that I am so prone to COVID. Last time, I'm like very active. I'm everywhere, you know, like every event, I'm there. Because I love events and I love outings. I love big celebrations. So every event, I'm there. Then now, suddenly I become like an ama already, you know, like a grandma. Then I like very weak immune system. I cannot go everywhere. Every time I see like event, I'm very interested. But then my mind automatically think, oh, well, so many people. I cannot go. So yeah, I feel very sad. Like, I mean, like, in our life. But then, of course, I know I'm very lucky compared to other people because I at least still have a job. I still have food and shelter and things like that. But then, yeah, it's like that. Like. So there are many instances where like all my friends, they plan something already. They're very, very excited. Then I want to go, but then end up I got COVID, so I didn't attend. So like a trip, graduation, wedding, a lot of outings. Yeah, another thing is that because I always quarantine in my small room, like, so I feel like friendships have been become more and more distant as well. And I mean, it's true that we can connect online, but then personally I prefer face to face over online. And also, how much can we talk via text, right?
I ask Weizi how she feels about the removal of the mask mandate and what does she hope that people will do to protect those who are more vulnerable, such as herself.
Honestly, I know that there's not much I can do because, of course, everybody is very happy to go back to pre-pandemic times. And then the removal of mask mandate, of course, is like beneficial for the environment. And also, like, everybody is very excited. But then for people like me, I think the pandemic is nowhere near in sight. Because last time, I still can go out, but very, very careful because I know that people are still wearing masks. But now that people are not wearing masks, so everywhere is a huge risk. So moving forward, I'm quite afraid, like, what will my future be like? I'm quite worried. I'm quite afraid, like, how do I navigate my future moving forward? Because not only, like, the personal factors mentioned just now, also this whole, like, you know, quarantine at home, it sure will affect career, right? Because sometimes if there are like overseas or outstation opportunities, projects, then I have to stay at home. And also like when there are a lot of office events or like office meetings, then I have to stay at home. So things like that, I think it will affect my career like by large or by small. So yeah, moving forward, I am quite afraid. But then also I know that I cannot control what other people do. So in terms of what do I hope for the future? Honestly, I don't really have an answer because like to think like in my wildest dream, like a very bold situation is that, everybody will continue to wear masks and continue social distancing and things like that. But then I understand that everybody has had enough of these like SOPs and everybody wants to move to pre-pandemic time. So honestly, there's not much I can do as well.
That was Liu Weizi, a person living with psoriasis, which is an autoimmune disease. And she was sharing how she has been affected by the pandemic, having been infected with COVID-19 four times in the last 6 months due to her immunocompromised status because of the medication that she takes for psoriasis. And next up, we'll be catching up with Assistant Professor Dr. Farhan Rusli, Public Health Medicine Specialist from International Islamic University, Malaysia, to look at this removal of the mask mandate, to do a roundup of recent COVID-19 developments, and we'll be asking him whether we're ready to declare the disease as endemic yet. Stay tuned to Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik. On the show today, we are discussing the lifting of the indoor mask mandate that was announced by Health Minister Khairi Jamaluddin last week. So right now, masks are only mandatory in public transport, in healthcare settings and care homes, as well as for those who have tested positive for COVID-19 and may need to travel to healthcare facilities for treatment. Before the break, we heard from 24-year-old Liu Weizi, who lives with psoriasis, which is an autoimmune disorder. She shared how the pandemic has affected her as somebody who is immunocompromised and what is the impact of the removal of the mask mandate and other relaxation of SOPs on people who are more vulnerable like her. Now I'm speaking to Assistant Professor Dr. Farhan Rusli, Public Health Medicine Specialist from International Islamic University, Malaysia, and we'll be doing a roundup of recent COVID-19 developments, including this announcement related to masking indoors. And we'll be asking Dr. Farhan whether we're ready to declare the disease as endemic. Dr. Farhan, thank you so much for joining me today. So to start off with, do you think we are ready for this move to drop the mask mandate, both indoors and outdoors, except for certain areas? What indicators are you looking at to make your judgment?
Well, I think one of the key aspects and the thing that we have never changed from the get-go was the incidence rate. It means that what are the infection rates, not looking at the absolute numbers. But at the same time, right now, I know that a lot of people are happy with the numbers being 2,000 plus a day and accepting it to be that. But we are always need to be reminded that there is a majority of the population who are actually getting infected in two categories. One, they don't know they're infected. And the second is that they do know they're infected, but they're not reporting it because they don't want to be stuck in their house, for example, over the school holidays and things like that. So obviously, infection rates are much higher than what is being published. And usually whatever you see is what we know as the iceberg phenomenon. You only see the tip of it. So although having said that, we also have to remember that even last time, that phenomenon actually exists. So in reality right now, I think infection rates are about 5,000 to 6,000 a day, to be honest. But we cannot be living in such a way where we are very restrictive and not moving forwards as more of the economy and the sector opens. However, having said that, we have to tread carefully. It's open waters because of very, very important things that actually need to be taken into account. Number one, and most importantly, is the vaccinations. We don't know how long the vaccination actually lasts in our body. We only know the signs as long as we have it in our body, and it's only been, 2 years plus? So we don't know how long it's going to last us. So we have to be ready whether it's going to be there for a longer period of time, if it doesn't be there. So as we relax ourselves, we also have to be very vigilant and prepare ourselves that things can go downhill at any moment's notice, and we have to be prepared for that.
All right. And what about indicators like the hospitalizations and number of people on in ICU and on ventilators? Looking at where we are now, would you say that we are managing the disease well?
Well, I think it's not about whether we are managing the disease well, because managing the disease last time used to require a lot of skills from our part. But right now, with Paxlovid being in the picture, antiviral drugs that actually show very great promise of not making people more sick and then keeping them in the category 1 and 2, that is actually the major game changer that's in the pandemic. So right now, not only are you dependent on the vaccines itself, but you already have another fight against the virus that you can actually prevent them from getting much worse. So that's why hospitalization rates and also ICU rates obviously are way, way lower than what they were before, thanks to a large part due to the antiviral drugs that are present. However, again, I want to remind that these antiviral drugs are meant for the current situation of the variants and stuff like that. We will come to a point where if mutations and VOCs actually mutate and they actually come into the picture, the antiviral drugs may not work as what is intended. Hence, bringing back to the main point where we have to keep re-educating, re-teaching and re-informing the public that the pandemic is still there and that at any time we need to be prepared. And when that happens, what should everybody do and what's their role in it?
Mm. So on the note of variants of concern, does it mean that we should actually always have in the back of our minds that if a new variant of concern that could either be more transmissible or potentially have more severe effects than Omicron, is identified, should we actually, sort of be prepared that some of these SOPs and restrictions may come back again?
Well, you have to put it in this sense, right? Looking at COVID, the trend and how the variants actually mutate and how fast they actually get transmitted as more variants come in, you just need to look at influenza. We don't have a cure for influenza, but every year we update the vaccines that we give to influenza. COVID itself will eventually, if it goes down this trajectory, be something like that. So as you talk about should you mask up or not, even if COVID was not here, if you had any sort of fever, any sort of cough, any sort of flu, you should already be masking up because you know that a flu means something has entered your body. A flu means that you are sick and you may transmit a virus to somebody else. So regardless whether COVID is in the picture, we should be educating our public that if you are sick, you should stay home. If you are unwell, you should mask up. And if this is embedded into the minds of the society, regardless of whatever virus comes into play later, people will be more vigilant in what they should do. So it's not only about restricting it to COVID, because people keep thinking, I have to mask up because COVID is here. But no, if you are unwell, you may transmit a lot of other diseases, tuberculosis, for one, there's so many things that can happen. So we need to be very smart and strategic in what we actually want to educate the public about on masking.
Do you feel that people have developed that ability to self-regulate and to kind of know when it's a yes to masking, when we can relax?
Absolutely not. So the reason is this. We are in a society where we are trend followers, right? So what happens is when everybody masks up, everybody follows. When everybody starts masking down, everybody doesn't mask up anymore. But what's critical here is that when you actually have that trend in society, it means that you have not attained the level of empowerment, which is actually the core value of preventive medicine, especially in public health. So empowerment means that people understand the need for masking, not asking the government, how about schools, right? Because there was this debate when the mass mandate was dropped. How about varsities? How about this, right? They asked the government, show us the way. Should we ask our children to wear a mask? Should we not? Which means that they don't understand the reasons why masking is important in the first place. If you understood the basic signs of masking, if you are immunocompromised, if you are in a high-risk category, if your kids are yet to be vaccinated, if you come from a family where everybody else in the house is sick, you should be masking up. Then they would know the reason for masking, not asking the government, if I enter this premise, should I be masking? If I enter here, I should not be masking. That means they don't understand the reason for masking. And this is, in part, not putting the blame to the people itself, but perhaps the government should think about its strategies of health promotion and how it's actually asking people to change their mindset and their lifestyles. And 2 years will never be enough. And I'd like to draw in your just a small history lesson. When the flu broke out in San Francisco, everybody masked up and then they masked back down. And then the government had to intervene and ask them to do it again. So at that moment, people did not understand, right, why it's necessary and all these things. But at this point in time where we have access to social media, we have access to a lot of platforms for people to actually learn, I think it's time we need to make sure that people are empowered. And only that will you actually have a behavioral change that's embedded in the public society.
What kind of strategies do you think will work? Because we've heard recently a lot about behavioral signs, things like nudges and all that. But from your perspective, what kind of strategies would you like to see?
Well, number one, you need to have a strategy that you have to stick with I think a lot of times we have a lot of strategies, but it doesn't follow through. You have a person saying we should do this and you adopt it, and in the middle of the way you drop it out, and then you have another person coming in saying, oh, this is the best way, and then again down the road it gets dropped out. So actually, let's think about this, right? Remember, we had a point in time where we had a national testing strategy. We had that in place, and we wanted to tell people that we have a playbook now about COVID and all these things, but yet we don't hear about it anymore, do we? You ask somebody, a layman down the street, do you know about the national testing strategy? They'll say, no, I don't know. Which means that we have a lot of things that's really good on paper. It looks really good in the book. But come implementation-wise, how much of translation to the public do we actually develop, do we actually pass on? And this is where the biggest problem actually comes in. We have a lot of ideas, a lot of brilliant minds from academia, from the public service, from the private sector. But the thing is, we have to remember, if you talk among the circles of intellectuals, the results will be very different than if you talk to the public. As when you talk about it among intellectuals, you will always think that the plan that you have is awesome, right? Let's just put it in that way. But the public doesn't understand what your plan is. So that's why we have this mismatch of paper versus reality, right? And whatever strategy that we put in, it needs to be very simple as the uncle, the atuk, the nenek in the kampung are able to adhere and understand. Something which doesn't require any sort of translation or health literacy for you to be able to comprehend what's being taught. And I think that's why the strategy needs to be something that is robust. Number one, you need to make sure that whatever you're trying to implement is sustainable and it needs to be repetitive. The more you tell people, the more that people will associate with it, right? So that's the level that you need to achieve with health, right? When something is spoken or something is heard, it triggers. And that's when you know that you've reached a level of empowerment and that attainment of change in the behavior of the people. Yeah.
Mm. So, you know, I did want to ask you about in schools and certain premises like F&B and other front-facing kind of a service, right? You've unfortunately burst that bubble for me.
Okay.
I mean, we heard schools, for instance, we heard the Ministry of Education announcing that, again, it's not mandatory, but it's encouraged, you know, using the same sort of principles that YBKJ had announced. So, I mean, I understand what you mean about people should be empowered to gauge the situation and make the decision for themselves. But do you think there's anything that needs to come in terms of guidelines for certain sectors?
Well, I think before we can actually start putting a lot of responsibility on the people, we also must make sure that the people are able to carry out their responsibilities in a safe environment. What do I mean by this? You have to touch now on the issue of infrastructure. I think if you look back a year, there was a lot of hype about ventilation and good air quality in indoor buildings, the proper opening of windows, you need to open up the doors and all these things. But looking at the root cause, all the malls stayed the same, right? Your offices stayed the same. Where you are in stayed the same. Was there any change? Did they put in a special HEPA filter? Did they actually clean up the ducts? If you go to restaurants that are air-conditioned, how many times do they actually clean the air ducts that actually suck the indoor air out, right? So if you just tell people you have to be able to mask yourself in situations which are risky, but the basic infrastructure does not help in the first place, then you're going to have a very big problem. Now this touches back to where schools are. Is the infrastructure, is the ventilation in schools already adequate enough that now with masking, your risk actually drops? Or has nothing changed? And even if you wear a mask to school, it doesn't help because the infrastructure doesn't allow you to practice good, healthy behaviors. So this is the critical part. And I think as much as we love to talk a good game on we're going to do this, we're going to do that, the enforcement is going to do this, we're going to check all the premises, everybody's going to be following our rules, but yet we see little to none. So when that's not enforced, you look at other things such as the human resource ministry about the enforcement on the proper housing for the workers, especially foreign workers, where they need to have good ventilation, they need to have good proper spacing so that they can actually practice good quarters in their sleeping. But is that being enforced? You don't hear about it now, right? So you would not be surprised as much as I am that if cases blow up, that it's not about masking. It's about the basic infrastructure, which has never been solved in the very beginning.
And there's a very real danger. All this is just going to be forgotten, right?
Well, I don't think there's any real danger that it's going to be forgotten because it already has. So the danger has actually been with us. And I mean, I people always say that I love to burst the bubble, you know. But the thing is, I love to say things that I see, and I don't see enforcement being done. I don't see changes to the housing quarters of foreign workers being actually played out. So in the end, we talk a lot of game, but we don't bring it, you know. So if you don't bring it, how are you going to achieve your goals or your targets? And then in the end, you tell people, look, I told you to mask up, but you didn't. But you never provided them a safe infrastructure and environment to start off with. Yeah.
You know, with regard to the mask mandate, we are sort of following in the footsteps of Singapore. They also removed the indoor mask mandate last month. And, you know, their report said that it was based on the fact that the disease situation there has improved because many people are fully vaccinated and have also caught the virus, and sort of alluding to the hybrid immunity. Would you be able to say that we've achieved hybrid immunity here?
Well, absolutely not. Number one, I don't think we should be following whatever Singapore does because Singapore's population is much smaller than Selangor State in the first place. The geographical location of Singapore is unique because it's an island state. At any moment or any given notice, they can just shut down all their borders and it can be done in about half an hour and everybody doesn't come in and nobody comes out and they can control any sort of new things. Imagine if you needed to do that for Malaysia. It's not going to be the same as Singapore, is it? Why I say it's not the same that we have achieved some sort of hybrid immunity is because we actually have a lot of the populations we are still unvaccinated. I'm not talking about the children, I'm talking about the adults. So if you look at the high rate, the high uptake rate of the vaccinations, the first two doses among the adults, those are all registered adults. I'm talking about there is also a segment of the population which are unregistered. These are your refugees, these are people with undocumented papers. The Sarawak and Sabah sectors, the people on the islands. I know islands in Sabah where a large chunk of them are still unvaccinated. So we are not going to be in that same situation. And the reason why this is very important for us to note is this. In an unvaccinated population, if you have an outbreak, the disease actually mutates. It needs a human host to actually mutate and change. So the more unvaccinated pockets of population you have, the more there is a high chance of mutation occurring. And you can look back in South Africa when they had the low uptake rate of vaccination because they couldn't get access to the vaccines. That's when Omicron came out, right? Mm-hmm. Now, why did I bring Sabah and the island into the picture? Because now we've opened up our economical sectors. We have opened up our tourism, right? So we now have people who are supposedly vaccinated going to these islands, right? We have people going to visit, we're going for tourism, but they meet populations which are unvaccinated. Mm. Now, these populations can actually transmit and pass the disease back to these people who are supposedly covered. But we know that some of the new variants are not covered by the vaccines that we took. And these people come back to the peninsula of Malaysia, or they even go back to their respective countries. And then you have another blowout breakout. So those things are going to happen. But how prepared are we? So I think that's why we cannot compare ourselves to Singapore, because their public health preparedness and response will be extremely quick to implement compared to us.
I should clarify that. I perhaps didn't word it well. I shouldn't assume that our decision to remove the mask mandate is following Singapore's, but more that they made the same move last month and you know, ours was announced last week. So let me just clarify that. But speaking of vaccinations, YBKJ made several announcements regarding vaccinations for children. So just some guidance, perhaps, Dr. Farhan, for how parents can make the decision decision for children aged 5 to 12, where booster jabs are available if they are in the high-risk groups. Also, children 6 months to 5 years, again, if they're in a high risk, as MOH is, I think, working on procuring vaccines for that younger age group. Any guidance for parents?
Well, I think if the parents themselves have taken the vaccine to protect themselves, it should be a no-brainer for them to actually take the vaccines for their children. But yet we see a lot of parents actually not wanting to do that. But like I said, there's a lot of harm if you don't actually take the vaccinations. And I think what the parents need to do is look at the data and always refer back to the science. So in the group where they love to do their homework, look at the homework and look at how many children have actually been protected and look at how many rates of hospitalizations and ICU admissions are for kids who are not. And I think that will be a very clear guidance on whether you should give this group of children the vaccines. And for the group, for the people who don't like to read at the data, just remember that protection is much, much better than no protection at all. So I think that's the key element that we should give to them. And the risk of your very high risk and immunocompromised children getting COVID will be much more severe than whatever the vaccines can actually do to your children. I think that's a key takeaway that these parents should understand.
So for the six month old to the 5 years old, that one is an age group. We haven't introduced any COVID vaccines yet in Malaysia. What is the science based from what other countries have done?
Well, I think there's a lot of threats to push for the vaccines to be given to kids under 3. And I think what's more important is that some of the vaccine manufacturers are actually pushing for vaccinations that actually covers the latest variants, BA, BA4, BA5 and all these things, because the previous other vaccines gave some sort of protection, but not total protection. I think they are moving quite fast and rapid, and I would not be surprised that before the end of October, because you must understand that the vaccine makers are usually in the Western countries, and they have to push out these vaccines before the winter season starts, because that's when you see the high peaks of infections for them because of the dry air and everything. So it's much easier for the virus to transmit and all these things. So I would not be surprised that approval would get fast track, especially by October. However, getting the vaccines into our shores is going to be a totally different matter. We also have our own regulatory bodies, such as the NPRA for approvals and all those things. So talking about in the context of Malaysia, I think it's important that we actually secure vaccines early. But you must also understand that the government is also factoring in the costs of vaccines and the economical impact to our non-existing public funds to actually buy the vaccines. However, I think procuring the vaccines and then perhaps subsidizing it or actually giving it for free if we can afford it, or actually just making parents pay for it if they could, because there are also other NGOs that can actually pay for it, is very critical for Malaysia. We have to learn from our mistakes. We were delayed a little bit in our first rollout for the vaccines, the first round. So this time around, we should secure it. And I think touching on vaccines itself, I think we have to remember it's not only about COVID vaccines. We also must make sure the influenza vaccines are gotten. So we have to make sure that we secure those type of vaccines. And another one is the HPV, the human papilloma virus, the vaccine, the HPV vaccine is critical. We've missed 3 cohorts of schoolgirls who are yet to receive the HPV vaccines that we need to catch up. So there's a lot of things that goes on for the health ministry, and we have to make sure that we be very proactive in actually catching up to all these vaccines that we need to secure. Yeah.
Just to wrap up, Dr. Farhan, as you mentioned earlier, you know, daily cases of infections, about 2,000 to 4,000, 2,000 to 10,000 deaths on average a day. Should we be comfortable with this as sort of so-called the road to endemicity?
Well, I think we have to put it in this way. Yeah, it will be okay if the public thinks it's okay. That's how, I guess, that's how the politics of the pandemic works. If people think 3,000 people getting infected a day and 10 people dying a day is okay, then the whole world will move on. But if we make enough noise and saying that, hey, we should be going for zero COVID deaths, why are people still dying of COVID? We should not be getting this. Then 2 to 10 will not be okay. To answer your question, I think we should not be looking at infection rates. It may be 2,000, 6,000, 10,000, regardless, but what we should be striving for is actually zero COVID deaths. So I think that's something that the public should be comfortable with. You may be infected by COVID, but we're going to make sure that nobody dies of COVID, because technically it's a vaccine preventable death. So we should make sure that nobody dies of COVID anymore. And that will be an indicator for me that COVID is okay to stay.
Mm. And a final takeaway, Dr. Farhan, on masking and other protective behaviors now that we don't have, we are not being policed anymore. How do we police our own behaviors? What are some principles we should keep in mind on masking?
I think to touch back on the main topic of masking itself, you have to remember that if anything happens to you, nobody is going to care. If you have that mindset, then you would actually know that the person who's most responsible for you is actually yourself. So you got to make sure that you keep yourself safe, and you must understand basic things such as whenever you want to use a mask, you got to know that there are masks that actually works and there are masks that don't work. So if you want to protect yourself from airborne diseases such as COVID, such as tuberculosis and all these other diseases, you need to wear an N95 mask. A cloth mask or a face mask is not going to do anything for you. And then you also have to remember that you have to practice hygiene practices, because not only are you supposed to wash your hands because you don't want to get COVID, but there are so many other diseases that you can get without washing hands. And I think it's really back to basic principles that what we learn in kindergarten is you have to take care of yourself. Jaga diri, remember? You have to take care of ourselves, because if anything was to happen to you, nobody's going to take care of you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Farhan. I've been speaking to Assistant Professor Dr. Farhan Rusli, Public Health Medicine Specialist from International Islamic University Malaysia, about the recent announcement of the lifting of the indoor mask mandate. You've been listening to Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.